Let's open up this morning with this picture of Mount Tabor as we are on our way to page 119 in the Harmony. We are continuing this morning our study of this singular event in the life of Jesus, in which for a second time God from heaven audibly speaks to endorse his Son, Jesus the Christ. In the last classes, both in the sermon and in our class time last week, I had focused on Mount Hermon, which is farther to the north and very much higher than this particular mountain, and suggested that it was maybe the more likely of the two places that are offered as the location for the transfiguration. Jesus went up, we are told, on a high mountain, and then this event took place in the sight of three of the apostles, that he was changed and became something that was superhuman and supernatural. The other location, the one that I think is a little less likely, is this Mount Tabor that you see before you, with an olive orchard in the foreground here. As I've been thinking about this week, though, while most people do prefer Mount Hermon, that is based primarily, brethren, if you'll come now to page 119, based primarily on this statement, look in the Luke column, if you will, that some 8 days after these sayings, it came about that he took along Peter and John and James and went up to the mountain to pray. But if you'll notice, there at the very bottom of the facing page, you know, above the index material at the bottom, in the footnotes, section 121 is the transfiguration, but they offer in italics there a high mountain, perhaps Mount Hermon. Most people suggest Mount Hermon because if you look more toward the middle of that page 118, and again in the italics under section 120's headline, it was near Caesarea Philippi that the preceding event had taken place. Caesarea Philippi is at the foot of Mount Hermon. It's almost suggests that he probably then ascended the mountain that was closest. But what did we just read at the very top right on page 119? How many days had passed since the events that we've been studying in the region of Caesarea Philippi? It's been 8 days. In 8 days, you could walk back and forth between these two mountains probably three times, maybe four. You know, so it's really hard to tell which of these two mountains is more likely the place. So we really do not know. The Nazareth ridgeline, one of the more beautiful places for sightseeing in Israel, is what you're standing on right here. Nazareth would be right at your back as this photo is being taken. And then you can see Mount Tabor there again. This is that magnificent Jezreel Valley plain of Jezreel, in which just an enormous amount of biblical history has taken place. And then you can just begin to see a little rise right there. That rise we'll be looking at in a moment, or I guess maybe it's a slide I have for the sermon later, so later. That Mount Moriah is also a very significant location, another very prominent mountain that rises up out of Jezreel. I didn't want to correct one thing I said last week. I said that this was a very volcanic-looking structure there, and surely you can see that it is. However, I did read this week that it is not actually a volcanic structure, so I didn't want to leave the wrong idea. It's not a volcano. It doesn't have a cone with a mouth at the top. But a beautiful location nonetheless, and maybe the place where the transfiguration took place. As you stand at the foot of Mount Tabor there, this is viewed from a field white into harvest, as I've named it there. You probably recognize that is me, and I'm standing there right at Endor, where the witch of Endor and the rising and the raising of Samuel took place is right there. As a matter of fact, I was able to reach down into the plowed part of the field. They always go around all these fields with a plowed area, and I wasn't sure why, but you know, it's very noticeable. And was able to pick up pottery shards from the first century, from Endor, just lying scattered about. So it's a very well-known location, no doubt about that. But here from the valley floor, it's easier to see how tall this thing is. It's 1,886 feet. So it's not huge, and the mountains in Israel, except for Mount Hermon, really are not. So I don't know. We'll take a census here. That's not a census, but you raise your hands. Is 1,886 feet a high mountain? No, it's really not, is it? It just doesn't kind of qualify. You know, I should have gotten figures, I guess, from Coburg Hills and Skinner Butte and that kind of thing, you know, to see. But it doesn't strike me as being what you'd really describe as a high mountain. This is another reason why folks rather lean to Hermon. Now, all that, let's go to the end, page 119. Luke's column will be our primary reading there. And you'll notice a big blank spot on the page where Luke alone points out at verse 31. Now, Jesus appearing in glory with, from verse 30, Moses and Elijah, were speaking of what? What were they talking about? And only Luke tells us. It is his departure, which he was about to accomplish at Jerusalem. So, bear in mind that at this point, Jesus is at least 9 months away from the crucifixion. That is his departure. He may be as much as a year, but probably not much more than that, away from the crucifixion. So when it says that he's about to accomplish this at Jerusalem, please don't get the idea that it, you know, that it's instantaneous, that it's really very close. It's not. It's probably about a year away yet. But that departure is inevitable. And that departure has become a very prominent theme in Jesus' teaching now. Starting with Caesarea Philippi, Jesus has begun now to really hammer the apostles with the idea that he will be tormented, abused, murdered, and in the not very distant future. So if you come back, for instance, to page 117 now, on 117, they're up very close to the top. You have section 119. Look at the headline they put on that. First, direct prediction of the rejection, the crucifixion, and the resurrection near Caesarea Philippi. So Matthew chapter 16 is where we usually go to read of Peter's grand declaration, "Thou art the Christ, the Son of the living God." "Blessed are you, Simon Bar-Jonah. Flesh and blood did not reveal this to you, but my Father who is in heaven." That's right. But now that they've got that, Jesus is the Christ, the Anointed One. He is the Son of the living God. What does Jesus then, now that you guys have got that much conviction, what's he immediately start teaching? The Christ, the Son of the living God, is going to be crucified. He needed, apparently, to get them to that decision and to that conviction in order to then prepare them for the relationship. It is precisely because he is the Christ, the Anointed One, that he will die. It is precisely because he is the Son of God that he must die as a sacrifice for our sins. So for apparently 2 to 2.5 years, he has been working with these apostles. Now, I'm not one of the prophets risen from the dead. I'm not just another prophet. I'm not just an amazing guy. I am the Christ, the Son of the living God. Get that. Cling to that. Now wrap your minds around this. I'm going to die. It's going to be horrible time and time again. So when we do get over here on page 119, we find Jesus speaking about that departure with Moses and Elijah while the apostles, these three, are in attendance. In verse 32, Peter and his companions had been overcome with sleep, but when they were fully awake, they saw his glory and the two men standing with him. So we're not told how much they would have witnessed of this event. We're not told what they heard about this event. They saw it. You know, we are now privy to the conversation's nature. Whether or not they heard it with their own ears, we're not sure. But in verse 33, this is really where we stopped last week, it came about as these were parting from him, Peter said to Jesus, "Master, it is good for us to be here, and let us make 3 tabernacles." What's the short word that starts with a T for tabernacle? Let's make 3 little tents here. One for you, one for Moses, one for Elijah, not realizing what he was saying. Now, how did he know it was Moses? How did he know it was Elijah? Brethren, I'm fairly convinced in my own mind they must have overheard the conversation where Jesus turned and said, "Well, Moses, the reason for that is," and yes, Elijah, you're correct on that. However, I would add, you know, I'm thinking that that's the only way because there aren't any photographs, there aren't any artist illustrations, you know, it's not going to recognize their faces, but they were given somehow to understand that's Moses, that's Elijah. We need to pay honor of some kind, and you're just exposed to the elements out here, so let's do something about that. But the last thing we are told there, of course, is how really bright is this suggestion? He does not know what he's talking about. He doesn't know what he's doing. He's just beside himself, and so the mouth starts running. Now, look at verse 6 in Mark's column. Verse 6 is unique to Mark. He did not know what to answer. Why? Well, he's terrified, so he doesn't realize what he's saying because he's scared to death. This vision is otherworldly, and it's quite frightening. And then, moving back to Luke's column in verse 34, while he was saying this, a cloud formed and began to overshadow them, and they were afraid as they what? Entered the cloud. Now, again, you'll notice something that's unique and important. Now, this time in Matthew's column in verse 5, right at the end of the second line there in verse 5, what's the nature of this cloud that is overshadowing them? It's a bright cloud. Ordinarily, brethren, if a cloud overshadows you, what has the cloud done to brightness? It's come between you and the sun. It is eclipsing that brightness. It is reducing that brightness. And so we have this overshadowing means now not so much in the sense of light, but in the sense of its presence. You know, I can overshadow you without casting a shadow, if I, you know, impose myself over the top of you. And then Luke makes the point that they actually entered the cloud. So here they are. They wake up. Jesus is talking to Moses and Elijah. Would this matter to the apostles? So astonishing. So they're trying to get their wits about them, you know, as they're waking up. And then there's this cloud. And this cloud starts coming down on them. And Jesus is transfigured. The cloud is glowing bright. And now they're entering into that thing. I'm guessing the terror is just about the only emotion that anybody would have had at this moment. So they enter into the cloud. And then at verse 6 in Matthew's column, this is unique to Matthew, when the disciples heard this, they fell on their faces and were much afraid. What did they hear? In Matthew, it is described as, for end of verse 5, thank you, Sharon, this is my beloved son, or Sherry rather, with whom I am well pleased. This is my beloved son with whom I am well pleased. In verse 35 of Luke's column, a voice came out of the cloud saying, this is my son, Luke doesn't record the beloved, my chosen one, listen to him. So, when you put it all together, this is my beloved son, my chosen one, in whom I am well pleased, listen to him, is the totality of what Yahweh said. Now, when Jehovah says this, how do you know that's everything he said? You got to go to Matthew, you got to go to Mark, you got to go to Luke. You have to look at the pieces and then what? Assemble them. So, this is the purpose of your harmony. Just whenever you study your Gospels, get out your regular study Bible, put the harmony next to it. Get all the data, no matter which one of the Gospels that you're studying. And then take that pencil and in the regular study Bible, make the notes at each of those locations. Here's where to find the other information, and here's unique information. Serve you extremely well as you go through the rest of your life, having then, in each of your Gospels, in your regular Bible, all of that data collected now. So then, as you turn the page, when the voice is spoken, it's still in Luke's column, Jesus was found alone. Mark says, all at once they looked around and saw no one with them anymore except Jesus. And Matthew tells us that in verse 7, Jesus came to them and touched them and said, arise and do not be afraid. And lifting up their eyes, they saw no one except Jesus himself alone. I'm loving this carpet. I really need to throw myself down on a nice pad and everything there, you know. But comes the cloud. Moses, Elijah, Jesus. Then they heard something about departing. You know, what is it? And then they're engulfed by this bright cloud. The voice speaks, this is my beloved Son, my chosen one, in whom I am well pleased. Listen to him. And by that point, what are the three done? Throw themselves on the ground. And perhaps just out of the brightness, just covering their eyes in stark terror. So then, Jesus will reach down, arise, that you can just see him, you know, looking up from the dirt, and then everything's just Mount Tabor, or Hermon, as the case may be, but nature has returned. Have they just witnessed something just truly astonishing? Now, God has endorsed Jesus from heaven with an audible voice at the time of his baptism. They've seen many a miracle. They've seen astonishing miracles, up to and including Jesus raising people from the dead. But this is just unique in New Testament and in Jesus' history. So, you would think something that impressive, which only three of the 12 apostles had witnessed, would be big news when you get down to the bottom of the hill, huh? Was it? Hopefully not. Because what we are instantly told is, look at Mark's column. In Mark's column on page 120, right in the middle, as they were coming down from the mountain, he gave them orders not to relate to anyone what they had seen until the Son of Man should rise from the dead. And they seized upon that statement, discussing with one another what rising from the dead might mean. And then looking at the last verse there in Luke, they kept silent, reported to no one in those days any of the things which they had seen. So, once again, and this is typically a marvel to me, I don't know, maybe the rest of you just immediately get it, but I don't understand why Jesus did that. And we see this several times. He does some amazing thing, and it really impresses people, and they're gaining information, insight into who he is and what he's all about. It's the very center of his mission to this earth. And then they're instantly told to not say a word about it. It's surprising to me. Apparently, it has something to do with them making a mess of it, I guess. It's out of harmony with the time frame. And so it's not ready, or they're not ready. He's Jesus not ready. They are not to say a word about it. However, in 2 Peter, if you were to look over there, but please don't, because I've got it for you right here on the screen. In 2 Peter chapter 1, Peter, who's one of these three apostles, he was certainly impressed. And so he writes his second, last letter that we have from him in the New Testament. He says, we did not follow cleverly devised tales when we made known to you the power and coming of our Lord Jesus Christ. But we were eyewitnesses of his majesty. For when he received honor and glory from God the Father, such an utterance as this was made to him by the what? Majestic glory. Second time he's mentioned that glory. This is my beloved Son, with whom I am well pleased. Sorry about the typeset there. I apparently forgot to embed the fonts, and so it got altered and not as visible as I wanted it to be. But that is the direct quote in 2 Peter that you found in Matthew 17:5. Peter chose to use precisely and only the words as Matthew recorded them in this quote.
such an utterance as this was made to him by the majestic glory, "This is my beloved Son with whom I am well pleased." And we ourselves heard this utterance made from heaven when we were with him on the holy mountain. So we have the prophetic word made more sure, to which you do well to pay attention as to a lamp shining in a dark place until the day dawns and the morning star rises in your hearts. So one of these days when Ron or Lenny or Charles is teaching 2 Peter, they'll explain to you what that day dawning and the morning star is. Those are difficult kinds of things there. I'll leave that to them in a later class. Yeah, you know, facetious. Of course, we'll teach on it someday, but not this morning. But what's the point Peter makes? Right there is a couple of them. Number one, when the Mount of Transfiguration event took place, what Peter derived from that first is this. We aren't following cleverly devised tales. We were eyewitnesses, and then comes number two, of his what? His majesty. He received honor and glory from God the Father. It was made to him by the majestic glory. This is, apparently, in all the life of Christ, the most majestic thing that the apostles ever witnessed. There is the aura of just supernatural glory that is visited upon Jesus in this moment. And it deeply impressed Peter, and he was forbidden to talk about it. Talk about gnawing your tongue for another year. You know? But when the time was right, finally, he could tell us about it, and he does. But he also said, we heard this utterance on the holy mountain. And brethren, to my knowledge, there's no other place where we can designate Tabor as the holy mountain and Hermon is not a holy mountain, that kind of thing. So we're still left not knowing which of the mountains are. I believe whatever mountain it was became holy to Peter, sanctified, set apart. It was altogether different than any other because of this event. Not because of anything that happened before, and not because of anything that Christians would do there later. So it wasn't turned into a shrine, anything like that. He was set apart by this event. But what he gets out of it is what he started with. We didn't follow cleverly devised tales. We have the prophetic word made more sure. So what should you do? Pay attention. As to a lamp shining in a dark place. What did he see shining? The majestic glory of the Father, the transfigured glory of Jesus and Moses and Elijah, and he came away from that with such conviction that he was willing to give his life, and he would give his life in the service of his King. And he wanted then, the readers of his epistle, all of which we are, to pay attention. This is my beloved Son in whom I am well pleased. What then did God say? Listen, here in another translation, listen to him. Okay? So, let's hope that we get it. Let's hope that it just makes us tremble and quiver to our bones when we think about this moment in Matthew. This moment in Matthew is supreme among all other presentations of Jesus. Now, Jesus' majesty, his superiority just in appearance and behavior to everybody else, comes up several times. That when the soldiers try to arrest him, with, you know, who'd come for? Well, Jesus, if you want him. What did they then do? Remember, they fell back. So he had to ask them again, well, who are you asking for? Never man so spake, they report. What is this a record of? It is a record of glory, of majesty, of dignity, of a demeanor that is just, you know, most impressive. It is supernaturally glorious. And so hopefully you and I too will just recognize we serve a risen Savior, you know, we sing. We sing a Savior who is simultaneously the Son of God and also called in the same passage among these verses, Son of Man. He is the, you know, the radiance of God's glory on this earth. Carol?
I look at this and they had baggage of Moses and Elijah. Mm-hmm. And they needed the reference to the listen to, because they had misunderstandings of or if they tried to apply it then, they would misapply it. And this talks as much more about his glory than the fact that you need to listen to him, but the glory is why you need to listen to him, and the others pale. And it's something that they had to have later so that they could put Moses and Elijah in the past, because they needed the new covenant.
Amen. I think everybody in the room would agree that this listen to him also carries, you know, that connotation. Listen to him as opposed to Moses and Elijah. Moses and Elijah, we're going to have reason to think about in the article that I wrote, you'll have occasion to read later, you know, and then again as we're thinking about our studies in Zechariah this evening. It is not just unrelated and coincidental, brethren, that Moses and Elijah are the two figureheads of the Old Testament. When the Jews spoke of the 39 books of the Old Testament, one of the primary designations that they would use was the law and the prophets. The law and the prophets. And it is, I think, it's undeniably apparent that Moses represents the law. Who does Elijah represent? The prophets. Both of them being, again, I'm using this word a lot, I think, this morning, the preeminent miracle workers of the Old Testament. If you're thinking about miracles in the Old Testament, first people come to mind, Moses and the plagues, Elijah, and a number of miracles, including a resurrection from the dead. Okay, so, outstanding. You bet. They've got to get beyond Moses and Elijah. They've certainly got something far more impressive here. All right, so, thus ends the transfiguration, and the fact now they must keep it secret for some time. Anybody have any comments or questions on that material or on that event? Okay, we'll press on then. At the bottom of page 120, we have then a continuation, something that flows out of this event, coming down from the mountain, and we'll use Mark's column first. They asked him, saying, why is it the scribes say that Elijah must come first? Well, the Old Testament says that, of course. Malachi says that in his last two chapters. But why is it now? Well, who'd they just see? It's got Elijah. Well, why did Malachi say that had to happen? He's putting it together. Why did Malachi say that has to happen? But is he putting it together quite properly? Apparently not. Because in 12, Jesus said to him, Elijah does first come and restore all things, which is, a colloquial way, a Hebrew way, a way that's a little bit odd to us in English. We don't quite speak like this. Elijah does first come and restore all things, kind of makes us continue to look to the future, though it's in the past. And yet, how is it written that the Son of Man should suffer many things and be treated with contempt? What did he bring up for now the third time with Caesarea Philippi? Being mistreated. Now, top of 121. But I say to you, Elijah has indeed come. So while it sounds future in verse 12, he's going to make sure we all understand that's already happened. And it wasn't what you just saw a few moments ago. They did to him whatever they wished, just as it was written of him. Well, fine. But thanks to Matthew's column, verse 13, top of 121, then the disciples understood he had spoken to them about whom? John the Baptist. So now we are told by inspiration how you properly interpret the last two chapters of the book of Malachi. When Elijah, a forerunner, is mentioned there, that Elijah is not the actual Elijah on the Mount of Transfiguration. It will not be a resurrected from the dead, physical Elijah walking among them. The Elijah name was used to speak in Malachi of John the Baptist, or baptizer is the idea in the message there. Now, I didn't want to take the time to have you try to turn pages, so I just put it up on the screen right here.
Luke chapter 1, verses 15 through 17 should be written in the margin at this location, and certainly in your regular Bibles as well. Luke 1, 15, 16, and 17 says, "He," speaking of John the Baptist, "will be great in the sight of the Lord, and he will drink no wine or liquor, and he will be filled with the Holy Spirit while yet in his mother's womb. And he will turn many of the sons of Israel back to the Lord their God. It is he," John, "who will go as a forerunner," Malachi, "before him in the spirit and power of Elijah." Can one have the spirit and power of Elijah and therefore be referenced by Elijah's name without actually being a resurrected from the dead Elijah the man from the Old Testament? Certainly, you have the spirit and the power. I'm coming to you what I know is going to be an extremely difficult emotional time for me. In 1974, I guess it was, possibly 75, I first heard the name Lowell Williams. I was in Denver at the time. I became convinced that he would be a teacher that I wanted to study with. So, in September of 75, I moved up to Kirkland, Washington, and would study with Lowell for 5 years. Then I would come back some years later, and I'd spend 7 more years attending his classes, so as to videotape them. He's become a lifelong friend for me. I was only 3 years old when, you know, I first became a Christian. Lowell is close to death. We don't know how close. The doctors are saying months, not a year. I called him this week. "Well, how are you feeling?" "Well, I can't get out of bed today. I'm hoping I'll be able to preach again. I'm scheduled to preach Sunday. I'm hoping today he'll be in the pulpit." Now, in my lifetime, and after I'd finished those first 5 years with Lowell and began to preach myself, I made one of those solemn vows to myself I've made my whole life. Close to getting married vows I made on that day. And that was, I will not be Lowell Williams. I will be Larry Haverstock. Okay? Because I had watched some of my fellow preacher students, and without ever recognizing it, I guess, they used the same speech idiomatic expressions that Lowell did. They had the same gestures. It looked like they were trying to be perfect imitators, mimicking him in every way. And it bugged me. See these little Lowells running around, you know. And so I fly at it all my life. "Larry, just be the best Larry you could be. And don't try to be a second-rate Lowell, you know." So I really tried to do that. But throughout all my life, what have I also striven to have in my life? The spirit and the what of Lowell Williams. Nobody knows their Bibles like Lowell, say, you know, a handful. Few people have ever come to the level that he has. Effectiveness? With just a radio program they had for a year or two, he said he lost count at 168 baptisms. Whoa, Nettie! Wow! You know, I've tried to be as fearless as him. He'd been involved in debates. I've tried to be as determined and as courageous. I've tried to be as knowledgeable. But have I tried to be Lowell? No. That's what this is all about. This passage in Malachi is about not the resurrection of Elijah, but about the spirit and power of Elijah. The second passage that you want to write in your marginal reference is Matthew chapter 11. In Matthew 11, verses 12 through 14, it says, "From the days of John the Baptist until now, the kingdom of heaven suffers violence, and violent men take it by force. Do you see how violence is being connected with the kingdom?" And he says, "For all the prophets of the law prophesied until John, and if you are willing to accept it, John himself is Elijah, who was to come in Malachi's day." How many chapters ago was that from what we're now reading? Well, 6 chapters ago. Okay. But what does it just say they just get?
Now I was talking about off the bat. Jesus said so. See, earlier. But do you sometimes find that after you learn something, you forget it? That after you learn something and then you're tested, you fail the test, and you have to back up again and say, you know, that's just a lesson I need to really learn again, or, oh yeah, I remember that now. So the same thing is happening with these very human men in their lifetimes and in their struggles to understand the Christ as well. So, fascinating passage there, very important, two other passages that go with it. And now, we've got 5 minutes. In these 5 minutes, I think we have plenty of time, this is just perfect what I wanted to do, to finish this healing of the demoniac. This will be, I wrote it next to verse 17 in Mark 9, demons number 11 of the 13 in Mark's Gospel. Here we start reading in Mark 9. When they came back to the disciples, they saw a large crowd around them and some scribes, arguing with them. Immediately, when the entire crowd saw him, they were amazed and began running up to him. So apparently, he's just come down from this Mount of Transfiguration. And he asked them, "What are you discussing with them?" One of the crowd answered him, "Teacher, I brought you my son, possessed with a spirit which makes him mute." And whenever, by the way, in Matthew we are told he is a lunatic and is very ill. And it's added, his only son, by Luke. But in verse 18, whenever it seizes him, it dashes into the ground and he foams at the mouth and grinds his teeth and stiffens out. And I told your disciples to cast it out and they could not. And he answered them and said, "O unbelieving generation," 122 Matthew's call, or excuse me, Mark's call him still, "how long shall I be with you? How long shall I put up with you? Bring him to me." Now, brethren, there's just no excuse or other explanation. Jesus is exasperated. He's just peeved at him. There's no other way to understand this. In Matthew, there still on 122, "You perverted generation, how long shall I be with you? How long shall I put up with you? Bring him here." See, at this point, we're 2 years into Jesus preaching, maybe 2.5. People, get it. Get this. Okay? So in 20, they brought the boy to him, or Mark again, and when he saw him, immediately the spirit threw him into convulsion, falling to the ground and began rolling about, foaming at the mouth. He asked his father, "How long has this been happening to him?" And he said, "From childhood. It's often thrown him both into the fire and into the water to destroy him. But if you can do anything, take pity on us and help us." And Jesus said to him, "If you can." I think again, brethren, he's frustrated. And good for the man. The man's desperate. I mean, we're proud of him, you know, for coming. But he's still, you know, offering this condition. He's still not rising to that kind of firmness of conviction that it really ought to be by him. "All things are possible to him who believes." And immediately, the boy's father cried out and began saying, "I do believe. Help my unbelief." And when Jesus saw that a crowd was rapidly gathering, he rebuked the unclean spirit, saying, "You deaf and dumb spirit, I command you, come out of him and do not enter him again." And after crying out and throwing him into convulsions, it came out. The boy became so much like a corpse that most said of him, "He's dead." Jesus took him by the hand again, very tender the way Jesus does this, raised him up, and he got up. And when he had come into the house, his disciples began questioning him privately, "Why could we not cast it out?" And he said to them, "This kind cannot come out by anything but prayer." Matthew adds at verse 20, "He said to them, because of the littleness of your faith." So apparently they didn't pray. And they also did not fast. I wonder if those buzzers get onto the tape. Okay, verse 20 again. "He said to them, because of the littleness of your faith. For truly I say to you, if you have faith as a mustard seed, you shall say to this mountain, move from here." Was it Tabor or Hermon he was pointing at? "Move from here to there. And it shall move, and nothing shall be impossible to you. But this kind does not go out except by prayer and, Matthew adds, fasting.
So, they failed. They failed apparently to believe they could do it. They failed apparently to pray about it. They failed apparently to fast about it. They just capitulated and gave up. And Jesus rebukes them for it.
That's why. Because you guys are still not fully getting it that you would be able to exercise this power. Thank you very much. Take an extra few seconds there. Meet again in 10.